my biggest point is, you know, I want to raise awareness. You know, if solutions come or if situations change, then hey, that's great, that's fantastic. But I don't think that I really have the power to make those changes. You know, my power is to raise awareness. You know, my power is to, through my films and through my work, let people tell their stories and raise awareness for these terrible situations that are surrounding these mega events, you know, not only World Cup, but, you know, also Olympic Games.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Austin Meyer Podcast. I'm your host, Austin Meyer. I'm a documentary filmmaker, and on this show, I interview the world's best storytellers in all sorts of genres about how they craft the stories they tell. This week, my guest is Benjamin Best. Benjamin is an investigative reporter, filmmaker, and author whose reporting focuses on the dark side of sports. He looks into things such as illegal betting, match fixing, corruption, organized crime, and the human rights violations that are often a byproduct of major sporting events like the World Cup and the Olympics. In 2011, Benjamin Best was awarded CNN's Journalist of the Year Award. He is the multiple-time winner of Media Magazine's Journalist of the Year Award. And in 2016, he came out with a documentary called Dirty Games, and he was awarded Best Director at London's International Film Festival for that feature-length documentary. Benjamin was born in Berlin, Germany, and now works for the German broadcasting network ARD and WDR, and he also owns his own production company, Benjamin Best Productions. In this conversation, Benjamin and I talk about his untraditional path into journalism, his advice for freelancers and investigative reporters, and then he takes us behind the scenes of his recent undercover report from Qatar, where he revealed how migrant workers who are building infrastructure for the 2022 World Cup are being exploited. If you're interested in seeing that video and that report, I have it linked at the top of the show notes and encourage you to check it out. It's a 16-minute video. It would be great context for this conversation. It is not necessary to get a lot out of this conversation, but if you want to check that out, it's at the top of the show notes, and again, it'll be just a little extra context for this discussion. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Benjamin Best. Kick it off right now. Benjamin, should I call you Ben or Benjamin?
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. All right, Benjamin Best, welcome to the Austin Meyer Podcast. It's such an honor to have you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, so you are coming to me from Munich, is that correct?
Absolutely, yes, Munich, Germany.
Okay, how long have you been living in Munich?
I'm living in Munich since 2010, so 9 years now.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I was born in Berlin, and from Berlin I moved to Cologne.
Okay.
And now I'm here in Munich.
What's your favorite part about living in Munich?
Have you been to Munich before?
So my family and I, we did a little bit of like Euro traveling, but I was pretty young. So I feel like I've been to Germany, but I actually can't remember whether I've ever been to Munich.
Okay. Well, Munich is in Bavaria. And, you know, of course, Bavaria, Munich is known for the Oktoberfest.
Right.
Actually, I'm not living too far away from the place where it happens. And they are already building the Oktoberfest now, you know, all the big tents. So people, you know, especially Americans, like to come here and drink the beer, of course. Mm-hmm. But Munich is also very famous for skiing, you know, for the Alps, which are not too far. And we have beautiful lakes around here. So, yeah, you know, I really like enjoying or like living here, of course, being from Berlin, that's my favorite city. That's where I was born. That's where I grew up, and but I really enjoy living in Munich.
Is Munich like a hub for journalism within Germany? Because I'm thinking of like in the U.S., you know, you kind of have a lot of media outlets are really in New York. There's also a lot in California, especially you kind of have your coastal media outlets, but like, are there a lot of international reporters or foreign correspondents who are based in Munich, or does that happen in Berlin, or what is it like there?
Well, from an international perspective, of course, most of the journalists, if not all of the journalists, are based in Berlin, because that's where the government is located, and that's the capital. But within Germany, we have a very, very good public broadcasting system, similar to the BBC mm-hmm. in England. So every state has its own network, and all of them combined are the public broadcasting network ARD. And there's a second program, it's called ZDF. So those are really big, major networks within Germany. And like I said before, you know, in every state and in every state capital, there's a location of this public broadcasting network. Of course, here in Munich, we have some private channels, which are also pretty big. I wouldn't call Munich really a media hub. You know, there are some big networks here, but of course, Berlin is one, Cologne is one, Hamburg is also one. So I would say we have many cities which have a really strong media presence.
Gotcha. And right now, are you working? Because I know you've been a documentary filmmaker before. You're doing video journalism. Like, what medium and what types of outlets are you spending most of your time working with right now?
Actually, during my career, I learned to do as much as possible, to work for as many media sources as possible. So right now, of course, you know, I'm working as a filmmaker for the public broadcasting network ARD. I'm also working on my second book right now, which will come out next year. And I'm trying to set up a feature for radio. So, you know, I always like to use every media source or every media outlet available and also possible, because, you know, I just like doing journalism. I like telling stories or writing stories. Yeah, you know, the main network that I work for is called ARD. And but I also have my own production company. So all the films that I create, I also produce with my own company. Yeah,
that's awesome. Well, I'm kind of a similar way in terms of just like have such a keen interest in telling stories in all these different mediums. So that's cool to hear that you're the same. And I wonder, like, when did you first develop an interest in journalism?
Oh, that's a very good question. Well, I don't have this typical career where I worked for the newspaper of my college or, you know, of my university. Actually, I started in law school.
Okay.
And I wanted to become a lawyer or a judge or something like that. Of course, you know, that was very popular with my parents. But after a while, I realized that that's not really what I wanted to do. And I was always into sports. I was playing soccer or football, as we call it here in Germany.
Yeah, we can call it football for the podcast.
Okay, good. but I was kind of always interested in the story behind the story. You know, the story behind the glamour of professional sports. And I was always interested in people and in, you know, what motivates them to do certain things. And after quitting law school, I decided to study sports. We have a very popular sports university in Cologne. And there's also, you also have the possibility to go into sports media, sports journalism. So that's what I did, and I graduated from that university, and I started to work for the channel that I'm still working now. So actually, I was like, you know, I think they call them late bloomers or late bloomers. late bloomers. Yeah. So I don't have this really classical journalistic career, you know, like I said, starting editing a newspaper. It all started a little later.
Right. So that university you're at where you're studying sports, you were doing sports media?
Yes.
Okay. And how did you first get into like some of this more investigative reporting? Because, you know, I'm thinking about my background, or when I started studying media or started studying journalism, obviously I started, you know, kind of doing the beat reporting, which it's like, you know, you're learning the top of your article and, you know, getting your quotes, and it's kind of like quick turn pieces. And when did you start developing that interest for investigative reporting?
Basically from the get-go, because when I finished college, it was very hard to get a job. I had to start as a freelance journalist, and, you know, all the top spots, like reporting from the Football Bundesliga, you know, which is very popular here. You know, all those places, they were all taken. So I had to be creative with my finding of subjects, of projects, and that's the reason why I had to go into investigative journalism, because the first big project that I had was a professional tennis player told me about match fixing and illegal betting on the professional ATP tour, and that really was the first big project and film project that I had, so that really was my start of my investigative career.
And with that first project on the tennis and match fixing, did you know right then that like you wanted to be making films and videos about this topic? Because some of the things that you've been reporting on, especially in your movie Dirty Games, right? That's the title of it?
Yes.
Yeah, Dirty Games.
Yes.
Like, I think some of it doesn't strike me as the most visual story. However, you find a way to bring visuals to that story and make it engaging in that way. However, I think a lot of these stories are kind of just told through text. I think you bring a lot of, a unique perspective through those visuals. So how did you think about like approaching some of these stories early on as a filmmaker?
You're totally right about that. It's pretty difficult and pretty hard, and it's a very, you know, it's a learning experience to make visuals about investigative stories, because there are different problems that you face, of course. Sometimes maybe you have a source that that doesn't want to be on camera, and then you know you have to think about, okay, how can I visualize this person, you know, what he wants to say, or a lot of events happen in the past, so there's no archive material, or you cannot film it because it already happened, and you know you also don't want to always use reenactments because you know that might be boring. So so for me, I really had to learn and had to see how does a picture develop, and is it boring for the audience to have a lot of reenactments, and can I maybe work with animations, and yeah, so you know, that really was a learning experience, and I'm still learning. You know, I'm still trying to see what other colleagues do and other great filmmakers do, and you know how they use the camera and stuff like that. So I'm still not finished. You know, I'm still trying to be creative with my pictures and you know try to work and look and find new motives and maybe some new camera angles. I think that's the most difficult part of being an investigative filmmaker.
And were you always working as a one-man team? Like you started shooting and directing and editing all your own work, or were you working with a team?
No, I was always working with a team. So I always really great cameramen, and you know that I've been working together for many years, and you know I know how they shoot, and they know what I want, but I also have my own camera equipment, so whenever there's a topic like the Qatar topic now, where I have to travel by myself because you know we can not be in a big team. Mm-hmm. Because we have to work undercover, then you know I can also film, but I also have a filmmaker, a colleague of mine, that is very experienced with investigative work in countries like India, for example, or another, you know, other countries in Asia or in Africa, you know, where you have to work undercover, where you cannot travel as an official journalist. So I have both, but most of the time I work with an editor and then also with cameramen.
Gotcha. Yeah, well, before we transition into talking about your recent reporting from Qatar, I'd love to just pull out a couple maybe tips or pieces of advice that you might have for people out there who are in that position that you were in when you were just starting out in journalism. Maybe they were a late bloomer themselves, or you know, all the popular beats or topics seem to be taken. They're freelancing and not sure how to kind of get their foot in the door. What advice do you have for people like that who are just kind of getting started in their career as a freelancer?
Courage. I think you need a lot of courage, don't get intimidated by people who have more experience, because most of the time they are just afraid that you take their job or that you do good work or good reporting. Educate yourself. Look at what other people do. You know how they create a scene, how they shoot films, how their films are edited. So I think those that's what helped me. I don't think that there's like a plan, you know, from 1 to 10 that you can just cross off, because you know every situation is different.
Right.
But I think I think courage and not get intimidated by more experienced journalists. That's one of or two of the most important thing and things. And also, don't be afraid to make mistakes, because I think we all learn from our mistakes, and making mistakes is just really, really important. In your development as a journalist, as a filmmaker, try to get your own camera. Try to play with your camera. Try to work. Shoot on your vacation with your families, and see how a camera works and what different things you can do with a camera. How you can shoot a video, do some close-ups. Try to find out the whole variety of filmmaking, of camera work, and I think that's what helped me, and that's what I'm still learning and doing right now.
Yeah. And I also really appreciate hearing you talk about you were interested in working those jobs that were covering the Bundesliga, which for here would be probably someone who studied sports media, sports journalism wants to cover something like the NBA. A lot of those top jobs will probably be taken and that road will probably be really hard. However, if you're what sounds like is you were very open to opportunities, to stories, to unique angles that other people weren't looking into, and when one of those came up, you ran with it, and you've kind of created a niche and specialty for yourself.
Yes, absolutely. So I think being a journalist, being a filmmaker, you always have to investigate. You have to investigate, and that also means to investigate your own situation. How can you develop as a filmmaker, as a journalist, as a human being? Which angle of a story might be interesting and wasn't or wasn't told yet, and that's something that helped me, and I also have to admit that that was a especially at the beginning of my career, it was a big struggle. It's not like I had a lot of work at the start when I got out of college, and that's also there again. You need courage to continue and try to really live your or reach your goals, reach your dreams, and I think especially now, with social media, with YouTube, all those possibilities that you have, that you can use. So you can be your own network, actually. You just like you do your own podcast, you could also have a channel where you show your films, and if you are good, if you have good subjects, then somebody will see it and will say, hey, this is a talented journalist that maybe has to should work for our network. It's a long way. Starting for me as a freelance journalist, still being one, but now I found my niche, and I am very glad, and hope that I can continue to shoot more films, more movies, and do other stuff as well.
Well, let's transition to talking about this recent story you did from Qatar. And I'd love to kind of walk through step by step the process of this reporting from developing the story idea to actually getting on the ground to the edit and publication. So maybe we can start with you talking a little bit about when this story or the topic in a general sense of migrant workers and World Cup infrastructure, when did that first start coming on your radar? Because I know it was also, you know, framed your film, which you came out with a couple of years ago, Dirty Games. So when did this first start coming on your radar?
Yeah, so I think this story is a very good example of, you know, how you have to look at the story for a long period of time, and sometimes it takes a lot of time to shoot a story, to develop a story, and this is a very good example of it, because I was in Qatar the first time in 2012.
Okay.
So that's 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. They got the World Cup in 2010.
Okay.
So I was basically following the story since 2012, and I was there in 2012 and 2013. And during that time, of course, you know, there were no construction sites concerning the World Cup. That started a lot later, but you know, in the whole Gulf region, of course, the topic of migrant workers is a very big one, because every country uses them, not only Qatar, but Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait. They all need migrant workers. So I've been following the story since that time frame. And my first trips there were not really focusing on the problem of migrant workers. It was sports though, but not the problem of migrant workers. That started a little later, when I think The Guardian, they were the first news outlet, I think in 2013, that did major reporting about migrant workers and how they were living, you know, the really, really terrible living conditions. And, you know, and that was also when I really got a first focus on this subject. And then came my film Dirty Games.
Yep.
Did you talk before? And you know, then it really was on my radar, and I put that topic in my film.
So, and then when it came up in these most recent stories you've been doing, like, what was the reason you wanted to go back?
The reason why I wanted to go back, because in the last couple of years, last two years, FIFA, so the World Football governing body and the organization FIFA, and the Qatari government, they promised change. They said that different laws changed, and that the situation of the migrant workers changed, that the labor standards changed, that Qatar tries or implemented laws and to have the international labor standards. And I really said, okay, well, let's go there again and let's check out what the situation is.
And when you're saying that, I imagine you're in Munich, you're talking with editors or your team at this point, and you want to go back and check to see if these standards that you and The Guardian have reported on, whether those have actually changed. Do you know what you're going to find? Have you scoped or storyboarded the story? Do you know what you're going for, or what is in your mind before you've set foot in Qatar?
Of course, you know, I knew what I want to find, of course, but getting there, getting to that point, is of course very difficult, because you have actually just a choice to go as an official journalist there,
Okay.
to get an accreditation from the government, so that you have to ask for permission to enter the country as a journalist, to work there as a journalist. And of course, then from many cases in the past, they really take you to the good camps, you know, where everything is okay, where the workers have really great camps. But you cannot really move freely. So, you know, there's no free press. So that was the first big obstacle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do I enter the country? Will it be officially, or do I have to go undercover and not reveal that I'm a journalist?
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first big decision I had to make, and I contacted a lot of colleagues that were already there, and asked them, what they think, how their work was. Some worked officially, some went there undercover. So that, like I said, was the first big decision.
Okay, and so it ends up, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen the piece yet, you did go undercover. And so
yes.
What is going undercover to Qatar? Like, what does that really mean? Does that mean that you just aren't bringing big cameras? Does it mean, I mean, because lots of tourists are coming in, so you just kind of like get a tourist visa and you just go do your work without notifying anyone. That's what undercover means in this circumstance.
Undercover, yeah, that's one part. Yes, that basically means that you go there and when you enter the country, you don't say that you're a journalist and that you want to work there or film there. But for me, it also means that. Talking to people that know the situation on the ground, getting a driver, getting a driver who also knows the situation of migrant workers, getting a driver that I can trust, that will take me to camps, that will not call the police. After deciding to go undercover, I realized very fast that this could be a pretty dangerous road that I was about to travel, because basically all of the people that I contacted, they told me, yeah, but take a other phone with you and don't take your laptop, take a new laptop, because in case you get arrested, they will go through your phone and then they will see that we had contact, and that will be terrible for my work. So I realized that it's a really tense situation, and it's a tense topic to work on. So that also means going undercover, and I think that I had a very good network, a network in Qatar, but also a network outside in other countries. That also was a part of my plan. And then, I was very fortunate to have a very good network and, to have very good colleagues here in Germany that say, okay, we will send you there and you will get our full cooperation. If something happens, we will talk to the German embassy and we will try to get you back as fast as possible. So, but of course, in the end, it was my decision, to go there or not to go there.
Right. And so are you alone when you arriving Qatar, and then you've identified a driver, a fixer, and these people, presumably through the network that you've built over the years in Qatar?
Yes, exactly. So, you know, that was a case where I went by myself. I had a small camera, and I had some hidden cameras, some secret cameras. And then, yeah, you know, I got in contact with my fixer and my driver, and I already had some contact numbers of workers that were presented to me before. And then the work started. So, you know, then we met the workers, they told us their stories that they did not receive.
Let me pause you there, because now I'm interested in this part specifically. Like, because this is something that I think a lot about as a journalist myself. So you arrive. It seems to me from watching the piece that you probably told the driver or someone, like, take me to where the migrant workers are. You go to this kind of like market or this area where there's lots of people around. And then you, as the filmmaker, journalist, have the very big decision of, like, choosing what people to tell this story, choosing the voices that will carry this, that will be the emotional core, that will create the narrative that is now out there in the world. And one thing that I'm always thinking about is just, like, what is the criteria to choose those people? And for you, was it, I just need to find somebody who will talk on record, who, you know, will be that face? Are you thinking, you know, let me seek out the worst scenario that I can find to really show the world how bad things can be here? Let me show the average situation. So I'd love to hear about how you are choosing the people to tell the story of this crisis of these migrant worker conditions working for the Qatar World Cup.
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, you know, we went to this market, you know, where a lot of migrant workers hang out after work. That's on Friday. You know, most of them are going there in the late afternoon. So, you know, there are really hundreds of migrant workers from Nepal, from Bangladesh, from India. And, you know, we talk to them and we ask them, you know, how their situation is. And basically, almost everybody said that their living condition is terrible, that they don't get paid what they were promised. A lot of workers also said that their passports are confiscated, which is illegal. You know, it's against Qatari law. So, you know, that's one of the laws that they changed, that, you know, that the companies cannot take the workers' passports. So that was one of the points that, you know, in 2013, when The Guardian first reported this, and you know, there was this big international outcry about the so-called kafala system. You know, that's the system where companies can really do with their employees and with their workers whatever they want to do. Mm-hmm. And the Qatari government said that, yeah, you know, we have to change this, and they said, you know, in the last couple of years that they changed it, but I found that, you know, that the kafala system is basically still in place. And, you know, also human rights organizations like Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International, you know, they also did investigations in the last years, and they also found out that the kafala system is basically still in place. So, but, you know, back to the market, the problem was that most of the people there, you know, most of the workers, they did not want to go on camera. They did not want to go on record because they were afraid of punishments, you know, by their bosses. So,
yeah, of course.
So that's why we blurred their faces in the film, and you know we couldn't really show them, but there, you know, I really got a first hint on location that the problems still exist, you know, even though there have been some changes on paper, you know, there are new laws, but apparently those laws are not really implemented, and a lot of workers, or you know, the workers that I talk to, you know, they still have to suffer.
Right. So, does this seem like an accurate recap, kind of that answer when responding to that question of like, how are you choosing characters? It sounds like in this circumstance, before doing any like official interviews or, you know, taking out the cameras, it sounds like you probably were just kind of talking to as many people as you can to get the context, to start to get the whole picture, to make sure like, okay, these are the conditions that people are living in. This is happening across the board. So that by the time you had those two subjects who said, we will go on camera, we will let you show our face and we will talk about this, by the time that they came forward, you knew that you weren't speaking to an outlier or something that didn't represent the whole. And you knew that because you had spent time, you know, many years obviously doing your research, but also when you got on the ground, you were having a lot of conversations with people to make sure that you knew the context. Does that seem fair?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, so I showed, or you know, the picture that I'm showing of these workers, that's the situation for a lot of workers. You know, this is not just a small part, and in general, you know, all the migrant workers have a fantastic life there, and they get paid, and everything's good. Mm-hmm. So you're absolutely right. So that was, of course, you know, part of my research as a journalist to get, you know, the big picture and then find workers that want to go on camera and want to talk about this problem, you know, this massive problem that is still there.
And then what really stood out to me is the part in the story, which I think a lot of journalists would not have done, is that you show how these conditions for these workers are impacting their families and the country that they left. And so just fast forwarding to that part, you go to the market, you find some workers, you go see where they're living, you talk to the people that they live with, you're showing these really horrific conditions, but then you choose, which is a big decision in both time and money, in the complexity of the story, you choose to go to Nepal and visit the family of these workers. And I'm wondering, from a storytelling perspective, like, what do you think that lent the story, and why you chose to make that investment in time and money to go report it that way?
I would say this was a very, very big part of the story. You know, we were thinking about at the beginning, okay, you know, if we find the workers and you know, if we talk to them, you know, then we have to show their families, because, you know, those pictures of those workers and those camps, you know, they weren't really new. You know, a lot of media outlets reported about those situations, you know, in the last couple of years. But, you know, we really wanted to show how this situation of those workers in Qatar really affects their families back home. And if you think about, you know, there are 400,000 migrant workers only from Nepal in Qatar. And if you think about, you know, those cases that we showed and those people that we talked to on the market, you know, they all said, yeah, you know, we don't get the money that we were promised, or we weren't paid for certain months. You know, that means that, you know, there are other people in Nepal or in India or in Bangladesh, you know, wives, children, mothers, fathers, you know, they need this money, and they also suffer. So once we found those workers, you know, we decided very fast, okay, you know, we have to go to this wife of Adi Gurung, you know, that's the name of the worker, and Dil Prasad, those are the two workers that talked to us. You know, we really have to go to this family of Adi Gurung, talk to his wife, see his two children, you know, how they have to suffer. And luckily, you know, I work for, like I said before, a public broadcasting network, you know, which can afford this type of shooting. You know, I think that's also very, very important, you know, that that you have a network that takes risk and has also the resources to send their reporters or their filmmakers around the world. And if a story develops, or, you know, is in research, you know, that they say, okay, well, let's react and let's send you to Nepal that you can film there and talk to the families. And, you know, that will really make our film full circle. So,
it really did. It really did. Yeah. I mean, so crucial to the story, and really was at the heart of it. And
and of course, you know, it was very, very emotional, and you know, the wife was very, very emotional. And just imagine not getting money for 8 months, and you know, she told us that she cannot pay the money for the school, and you know, she's really struggling, you know, with food and clothes and stuff like that. So, so, you know, that's the other part of a World Cup that will be in 3 years. And, you know, that 100,000 of workers are building stadiums for, and hotels and streets and the whole infrastructure. And, that means that people are suffering.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things that struck me so much, is you just see, you see at the start, like, those familiar images, and it's shocking. But then when you go to Nepal, when you zoom out and see how big these reverberations are, this impact is, on other sides of the world, it, like, it really hits home. I'm wondering what was like when you finished the reporting of the piece, what was the most challenging part in terms of putting it together? Or maybe by the time you finished filming, you kind of knew what you had and it came together pretty quickly. What was that like?
Well, the most challenging part, and there were a lot of discussions with the network, was the length of the film. So basically, this program that I work for is half an hour, and they always have three reports, which are 10 minutes.
Okay.
You know, which is a nice length to tell stories. But you know, once you know, we got more and more and more research, and I really told them, well, or I asked, well, I think we need this piece to be longer than just 10 minutes, because, you know, we have so much good material. And, you know, that's also part of the fight of a journalist, you know, mm-hmm. that you don't get that, you know, don't get more time, you know, even though you think you have, you know, very good material. So, But the network reacted and they realized what they have. So they skipped one report. So there were two reports in the 30 minutes. So that meant that that my film could be longer. I had 16 and a half minutes, and the other report was shorter accordingly. So, and then the editing part was was not really that hard. You know, I mean, we had the material from Qatar. You know, we had the secret filming in the camp, and you know, once we had Nepal, you know, it was you know, I wouldn't say easy, but you know, it was,
you had the story, you knew what you had.
It was nice. Yeah. You know, and then we could finish it.
And I saw that you posted on Twitter this week that reporting that you did in Qatar has already had some impact on the ground. Can you give an update on what has happened since you've come out with this story?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I mean, this really is very, very gratifying. And, you know, that's why we are filmmakers. That's why we are journalists, you know, to make a difference. And sometimes that happens. And, you know, when that happens, I mean, you know, it's a fantastic feeling that you can help people. So, next to Dil and Adi, we found altogether I found 125 workers that were stuck in Nepal that had their passports confiscated.
We're stuck in Qatar, right?
Yes, stuck in Qatar, and their situation was so terrible. You know, that's the main reason why they said, okay, you know, we will go on camera, we will show our faces. You know, we want to tell our story on the record because, you know, we've been living here for 8 months and, you know, we haven't received money. Our passport is confiscated. You know, we can only drink water and eat bread. It's, you know, we feel like prisoners. So once we contacted the authorities in Qatar and the FIFA, you know, we found out that they got their passports and that they were able to leave Qatar, you know, leave this terrible situation that they were in for 8 months, and they were at least able to go back home, even though they are still lacking their salary, so they did not get the money that they earned. And that, of course, you know, it's another terrible thing that they had to leave Qatar without their salary. But you know, at least they're back with their families and they are safe. And you know, now they can work on trying to get their money.
Yeah. Well, that's great to hear. That, I mean, the title of the piece was Trapped in Qatar.
Yes. Trapped in Qatar, yes.
So, I mean, that's great to hear that they were able to reunite with their families, and that's got to feel amazing for you. And it kind of transitions into something that I also think about as a journalist is, you know, what role do we play in talking about solutions? You know, obviously that wasn't totally in the scope of your 16-minute piece. And I think oftentimes when I'm doing reporting, I'm also not talking about solutions. I'm just kind of making people aware of things. I'm exposing, I'm documenting. And I think, I believe, and that's why I do what I do, that can have a major impact. But I wonder how you think about proposing solutions. And layer one more element onto this. You can kind of take it where you wish. I had a question come in from one of my Patreon supporters named Dursu Abulfathi, who also has seen this story of yours. And as a football fan himself, he is just wondering what can we do as spectators to help rectify this injustice that is happening around these major sporting events like the World Cup. So I know that was a long question, but maybe you can talk a little bit about Dersu's question and also about proposing solutions in the work we do as journalists.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very, very good question and I think a very important topic. And I also would say, you know, just like you just said, that, you know, first of all, you know, I really want to raise awareness with my reporting. And, you know, I was in Brazil for the World Cup, and I documented the evictions there, you know, people losing their homes, you know, for the Football World Cup and also for the Olympic Games. I was in South Korea for the Winter Olympic Games, and you know, I saw firsthand what this event meant for the people in the area of Pyeongchang, and now, you know, with the World Cup in Qatar, basically, you know, my biggest point is, you know, I want to raise awareness. You know, if solutions come, or if those situations change, then hey, that's great, that's fantastic. But I don't think that I really have the power to make those changes. You know, my power is to raise awareness. You know, my power is to let, you know, through my films and through my work, let people tell their stories and raise awareness for these terrible situations that are surrounding these mega events, you know, not only World Cup, but, you know, also Olympic Games. And the solution, I think, you know, really every football fan or everybody who's interested in soccer has to decide for him or herself, you know, will I watch this World Cup? You know, is this really something that should be part of the sports world? You know, why is it part of the sports world? You know, because I think that the viewer and the fan, you know, has a lot of power, because that's really, you know, where the money is. You know, that's why networks buy these ridiculous or pay these ridiculous amounts of money for the rights, because, you know, they know that, you know, there are millions of people tuning in to these events. But, you know, if the fans don't tune in and say, hey, you know, this is enough, you know, this is, you know, we cannot take it anymore, you know, we don't want this, you know, we want to enjoy sports, but, you know, we don't want that this is such a big, big business, mm-hmm. You know, then, yeah, you know, like I said, you know, everybody has to decide for him or herself. You know, I'm not so naive to think that, you know, people will not look at the World Cup, because, you know, it's one of the biggest sporting events in the world. But from my experience, you know, talking to fans, and also, you know, getting a lot of reaction from viewers to my work now, there's a big change. You know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, you know, people weren't really this active, you know, especially here in Europe, you know, thinking about you know, the consequences of these mega events. So, you know, I've been contacted by a lot of fans that said, okay, yeah, you know, this is really terrible, you know, and I will not go there, or I will not look at games. And, you know, of course, they also asked me, you know, what can I do? You know, can I help these workers? And so, you know, I really have to say that there's a change in thinking. There's a change of the mentality of sports fans, you know, at least here in Europe and in Germany.
Mm. Well, that's super interesting, and yeah, and thanks for sharing that. I think this is one of the reasons why this is such an interesting topic to report on, is you have, you know, these mega events. It's like these governments and governing bodies like FIFA using the events that we love the most in this world as kind of a shield to do some really terrible stuff. And it's a really complex topic. It has reverberations, like we said, across the whole world, and it's really complex. And, you know, yeah.
Yes, maybe one, you know, one more important or very, very important thing is that, you know, on the one side, you know, you have the big leagues and associations and federations, you know, obviously they are not interested that there are reports about the negative aspects of sports. But on the other hand, you know, you also have the fans, you know, and the viewers. And I think this is a problem around the world, that, you know, people look at sports as a, or as entertainment. You know, they want to be entertained. You know, they don't really think about, you know, are these players taking steroids, or you know, what happens in the background? You know, is there corruption going on? Is a game fixed? You know, they want to be entertained, and that's, you know, what the leagues and the teams and, you know, a lot of officials in sports have created. It's, you know, a mega entertainment industry. I mean, I don't have to tell you this, you know, what's going on in American sports. You know, it's a huge entertainment industry. And you know, a lot of people, you know, they don't really want to deal with negative aspects in sports. Yeah. So you know, again, you know, from maybe the beginning of our conversation, you know, that's a big part of my work, you know, to tell you know, important and good stories, you know, that people want to watch, you know, even though maybe they're not interested in critical aspects, you know, they just want to be entertained. But, you know, if you have a good story to tell, you know, then I would guess that more people tune in and more people want to watch it, even though maybe they are, you know, they're not really interested, or, you know, they never thought about these aspects. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, especially for investigative sports journalism, that's also very, very important, you know, to reach the audience, you know, even though, you know, they might look at sports as entertainment.
Yeah. Well, we're almost out of time here. A couple last questions here for the main show. Just getting back to, you know, looking at advice for people who are looking to become better storytellers themselves. And as an incredibly accomplished investigative reporter like yourself, what qualities do you think make a good investigative reporter?
Well, I think a couple of years ago, a journalist once told me that there is nothing like an investigative journalist, because every journalist should work investigative. So I think that first of all, you know, you have to listen, you know, you have to be able to listen, and to, you know, to listen what people tell you. And that sometimes, you know, takes time, because, you know, especially if you have topics which are, you know, complicated or not easy to talk about, because, you know, of different reasons, death or sickness or, you know, stuff like this, you know, it takes time to open up people, but, you know, you have to be able to listen. Then this is a little different here in Germany, because the journalist is not really part of the story. I know that, you know, especially in the US, you know, you have the reporter, you know, in the picture, and, you know, they, you know, he takes you through the story. So I think that you know, for a filmmaker, or, you know, for a good journalist, that or, you know, what I do is, you know, I'm not really part of the story. You know, of course, I mean, there are the Michael Moores that, you know, that do it differently, and, you know, for them it works, and they do really great stuff, and they, you know, I mean, he's a great, you know, very, very, very good filmmaker. But, you know, for me personally, you know, it's more important to have the protagonists in the story, and, you know, not the journalists. So but again, you know, I also, you know, I encourage people to, you know, just to, you know, to try and make mistakes and learn from those mistakes. So so, you know, there's no concept, you know, like I said before, you know, just go out there and try it, and, you know,
Well, as we wrap up the main show here, I just want to tell the listeners, Benjamin has been kind enough with his time. He's going to stick around for a little bit of a post show. The post show is available to Patreon subscribers. Patreon is a little subscription platform where you can support the show and get access to all cool features like post shows with our guests and additional episodes for as little as $2 a month. And today on the post show, we're going to be asking a couple questions that we didn't get to here on the main show, but also some fun questions. Like we're going to ask Benjamin a little bit about the gear that he likes, everything from, you know, how he's taking notes to what camera he likes shooting on. And then I also, you know, as a football fan myself, in the post show, I'm going to have to ask him about what football team he supports. So if you want to hear some of that, go on over to patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms, and you can get access to all the post shows with our guests and support the show. And to wrap up, Benjamin, where can people go to find you and to find your work? Where should they go? Social media, or where should we send them?
I mean, the best would be to go to my website, benjaminbest.de. Mm-hmm. You know, you can find all of my work there. I'm also on Twitter. My handle is bpbest. You know, you can find my opinions and also, you know, links to my work there. You know, I think that my homepage is probably a good start.
Yeah. And folks out there who want to check out his Twitter, I do recommend that. And Twitter also has some good translation features on there, because I know I've been translating some of the tweets in German on his timeline.
Yes, you know, I also put up some English stuff, but, you know, most of the time, unfortunately, it's in German.
So I end every show by asking my guests what advice they have to people who want to become better storytellers. I think thankfully we've touched on this a number of times in the show, but I wonder if there's just anything you want to leave the audience with, whether they're telling stories as artists, as writers, as filmmakers, anything else that you want to kind of leave the audience with today.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, what works for me, and I think it's just very important, you know, to be prepared, you know, to know, you know, which story you want to tell, and to have your equipment and your gear ready, and you know, check your batteries, you know, do little things that are very important. And yeah, I think
that's great. Pay attention to those little details. Preparation.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Cool. All right. Well, Benjamin, thank you so much for joining the Austin Meyer podcast. It's been, I learned a ton, and keep doing your amazing reporting, and I'm so excited to keep following it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
That's it for episode 27 of the Austin Meyer podcast. Thank you so much to Benjamin Best for coming on the show, and to you for listening. As I mentioned, Benjamin stuck around for the post show where we talked gear, journalists he looks up to, and he also gave a surprising answer to the question I asked about his favorite football or soccer team. If you want to hear all that, you can listen to this week's private podcast exclusively on Patreon. It is going down over on Patreon. Patreon is the best way for me to fund this podcast and keep it coming into your feed. So if you subscribe to the Austin Meyer private podcast on Patreon, it's just $2 a month, like half a cup of coffee per month. And when you do so, you'll receive a personal link so that the private episodes, the post shows, additional episodes play in your favorite podcast app. So if you're interested in that, head on over to patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. And I thank you very much. If you want to get in touch with me directly, hit me up on social at Austin Meyer Films. Love hearing from listeners about what is resonating with you. And let me know if you have any storytellers out there who you'd really love to hear on the show. I'm always reaching out to people, trying to fill that pipeline of episodes, and always looking for new people that I might not even know what kind of work they're doing. So feel free to just send me a message on social saying whose stories you're really enjoying these days, and I can reach out to them, see if I can get them on the show. All right, that's it from me. I will see you on the next episode of the Austin Meyer podcast. And until then, go out and tell some stories.